my name is Michael McCusker. As you probably know, we've had a succession of holidays, sort of. Caesar Acupuncture Day was on the 15th, the Ides of March. Yesterday, the 16th, was St. Urho's Day. I think we're 30 or some odd years into that. And today is, of course, St. Patrick's Day. But yesterday was also the 43rd anniversary of Mihaly. And 40 years ago, last month, a bunch of us Vietnam veterans held our winter soldier testimonies prior to going to D.C. and throwing our medals and 100 pounds of chicken defecation on the Pentagon. So I'd like to read something I wrote, Mihaly at the Millennium, starting with a quote by Chateaubriand. America still inhabits solitude. For a long time yet, her wilderness will be her manners. And that was a quote from 1827, and I should probably give the disclaimer that this is my opinion, and perhaps my opinion only in the entire universe, or universes. Mihaly at the Millennium. A long time ago in a previous century on the other side of the world, when I was in many respects a different sort of person than I think I am now, I carried a rifle and wore a helmet. I lived in mortal fear of death on a primordial plane of human relations and wept openly over the deaths of men who had been my friends, at the same time trying extremely hard to be cold toward the deaths and pain of Vietnamese I helped kill or injure. It did not matter whether I considered myself compassionate or humane. It made no difference. I really did not want to kill or injure Vietnamese because I wasn't able to convince myself they were my enemy. What did matter was that I did those things to people I really had no reason to do them to, except I had made a decision that gave me the opportunity. I reenlisted in the USMC, specifically for Vietnam. For several years afterward, I was publicly repentant. It took a while to move away from the merely confessional. I don't believe I will ever be completely free of the onus of guilt I still feel 45 years later about the things I did while at war. Yet somewhere along the line, I finally began to realize that confessions on an individual level quite often perpetuate iniquity on a mass scale. Personal guilt makes it easy to hold a single person responsible for an entire nation's genocidal attitude toward other people. Over the years, many of us leprous voices in the wilderness found ourselves coming closer together, beginning a slow evolution beyond our confessionals, understanding them to be intricate blocks against eradicating the iniquities themselves. By contenting ourselves with only disclosure and not with unearthing the diverse, complex roots of the grotesqueries we participated in, we only allowed ourselves and those who listened to conveniently beat our breasts against the wailing wall and do little more, safe in justification of our powerlessness. The evolution was slow and hard. Many of us who fought as oppressors in one war, which indeed we were to the Vietnamese we claimed to protect, found ourselves oppressed in another, this time a war against a war, conveyed in the streets of the homeland. The riflemen became victims. Our heads were bloodied in mass anti-war demonstrations, which were a sense of masturbating ineffectively against a power structure more able and willing to flex greater muscle and violence than we could either muster or withstand. Perhaps most of us who fought in Indochina needed to face the police clubs in the streets. It began to make us understand, through fear and pain of being unarmed and helpless when charged by heavily armed police and National Guardsmen, a sense of what it was like to be Vietnamese whenever we blitzkrieged through their villages with rifles and torches, our Zippo lighters. The killing of Iraqi civilians by U.S. Marines in the small Iraqi village of Haditha 5 years ago awakened old nightmares from when I first returned from Vietnam 4 decades ago. Back then, the nightmares assaulted me like machine gun bullets, one endlessly after another. Time has calloused the strung-out nerves and disbelief and guilt at having lived when it seemed everyone else died. I used to half wish I had been killed in country. There would be no nightmares stenched with horror. I don't really know if I killed anyone, but I certainly was in on the killing of hundreds, maybe thousands, whose villages I helped search and destroy. Villages we disdainfully called deja vu because they all seem the same. The murders in Haditha are compared to the slaughter of at least 500 civilians at My Lai in Vietnam in the spring of 1968, on March 16th, to be exact, yesterday, 43 years ago. Everybody in the USA surely remembers My Lai. After My Lai and the Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese Army and Viet Cong that immediately preceded it, most Americans began to lose heart about the Vietnam War. Americans don't like to believe that American soldiers could ever cold-bloodedly butcher innocents. We deny the culpability of Americans to kill without extreme provocation, yet passively allow our leaders to bully the world with nuclear erasure, presiding over an immense complex of technological, indiscriminate mass genocide. Is there any difference between the death of one murdered man, woman, or child, or 500? Is death at rifle point worse than death by bombs dropped from the sky? By the time My Lai was revealed more than a year afterward, most of us who had already been in Vietnam knew our small roles we had played in Indochina. Many seemingly accepted what we had done and tried to get on with the rest of our lives as if Vietnam was a brief and not at all definitive aberration. Others clung to their beliefs that no matter how hideous the atrocities, the war was just. But others of us, as a result of our experience, and through long and torturous sessions with conscience and brain, knew the fear and horror that had made us, each in our individual tours of terror, the final extensions of American foreign policy. For years, we had told of the wholesale atrocities committed as a matter of policy against Vietnamese and later against Cambodians and Laotians, but hardly anyone believed us. For years, we clashed in the streets with police as well as soldiers whom we felt were sent to chop down their own brothers. Then came the disclosure of My Lai, and the immediate response was that it was an aberration. It had never happened before and never would again. The soldiers of that massacre were monsters, not Americans. And if indeed they were monsters, what were the rest of us who had committed similar atrocities against Vietnamese, but not at that large a scale? Also monsters? It is difficult to chronicle when each of us changed. Some of us began our slow metamorphosis in the midst of war. Others when the immediacy of death and fear were behind us, and the questions of what we had done could no longer be avoided. Each had changed in his own time and for his own reasons. We had already formed Vietnam Veterans Against the War when My Lai was disclosed. My Lai sparked us to counter the singularity it was claimed to be, and that only a few bad apples, and that's a quote, were responsible, which remains the mantra for the tortures at Abu Ghraib prison and the slaughter at Haditha. We held testimonies based on Bertram Russell's crimes tribunals held earlier in England, first in December 1970 in Washington, D.C., Citizens Inquiry into U.S. War Crimes, and the Winter Soldier investigations in Detroit, Michigan, 40 years ago in February 1971. The 3 days in D.C. involved 40 Vietnam veterans. Detroit had more than 100. But we knew from personal experience that body counts were absurd, although the war revolved around them, as also in Iraq and Afghanistan, however much it is denied. The platoon of dissident veterans in D.C. had grown to company strength for Winter Soldier, a small army in its own right of former soldiers, finally moving past individual breast-beating confessions to an angry political activist demand for the destruction of the war machine and the corrupt system it symbiotically supported. We did not lay out the crimes we had committed in the name of America for forgiveness. Our purpose was not to wallow in guilt. That was the best thing that resulted from Detroit. We felt we were worth more than the extent of our guilt. We testified for 3 days, sitting at long tables shoved against one another, long hairs, liberals, and hecklers in front of us. One elderly woman waved an American flag while shrieking that we were cowards, communists, and queers. And that's a quote. We told of genocide, psychological and physical, of forced urbanization, removing farmers and their families from their ancestral villages and leaving them to starve in the cities, of wholesale defoliation of jungles and fields, of burning and pillaging hundreds upon hundreds of villages, of indiscriminate bombing with high fragmentation bombs and fiery napalm, of harassment and interdiction artillery fire nearly every night with no particular targets, just shooting up the countryside. And we told of free fire zones where everything that moved was fair game to be killed, no questions asked. We pieced our individual roles together like parts of a puzzle, stringing the years of the war together, and we built a web of premeditated policy from the highest levels of the U.S. government dedicated to the systematic obliteration of an entire culture through the genocide of war, of economic domination, of propaganda designed to disguise the war's true character of carnage and blunder, leaving few alternatives for Vietnamese except submission or death, and torture if suspected of resisting. We were talking to ourselves and we knew it, but it strengthened the unity between us. We told each other who we were and where we had been. We were a gathering of freaks who used to be death machines, ex-Marines, soldiers, sailors, pilots, machine gunners, prisoner of war interrogators, past POWs of the National Liberation Front, Viet Cong, who had escaped or were released, past prisoners of U.S. military stockades or brigs, helicopter gunners, fighter-bomber pilots, military advisors to the South Vietnamese Armed Forces, former military intelligence operatives, Agent Orange loaders and deliverers, and infantrymen, the grunts, who lived at every moment of every day, subsisting in mud and rain and blistering sun, snipers picking them off singly, ambushes wiping out whole outfits in seconds or hours. These survivors testifying to war crimes alive, while so many died or lost pieces of their bodies, such as arms and legs, to mortars, rockets, or landmines and booby traps. And some of those shaggy bearded freaks in Detroit were crippled from the war, stumping along on aluminum legs, holding cigarettes in steel clamps, and prominently among us, blacks, Asians, Latinos, and American Indians, America's disenfranchised minorities swept up to be out in front, to kill or die. But we were masturbating and we knew it. Hardly anyone listened to us, and many of those called us phonies, cowards, and traitors. The media ignored us for the most part. What coverage we received was vicarious and ingenuously sensational, generally referring to us as alleged veterans, and that's a quote, although each of us presented our documents of legitimacy. The Pentagon, as it usually does, denied our accusations while attempting to put the double onus of proof and guilt upon us instead of itself. Anti-war Iraq and Afghanistan veterans have held their own winter soldier testimonies and have likewise been treated with media blackouts, which are somewhat alleviated by internet coverage. The lesson of our testimonies in the slaughter at My Lai, which inspired them, was that the institution of war and its corollary, militarism, must be the accused, not a ham-picked few of its instruments. The extermination of Vietnamese who died at how many uncounted My Lais, and in Iraq and Afghanistan, the however many unreported hadithas, must be blamed upon the great hungry war machine we have built, not upon its lowly lieutenants, sergeants, and privates, whose major crimes, aside from sanctioned murder, are that they were caught at something they were directly or obliquely ordered to do. The American military, for all its puffed-up pretensions, is American society stripped of its pretenses. Virtually everything leading to the birth and formation of our society and everything to maintain and expand it has been drenched in human blood. War takes little imagination, however complex the battle plans and sophisticated the weaponry once it is begun. We are a warlike nation to our very core and self-concept, as well as deceit, heir of imperial Rome, restlessly savage Vikings, and in our empirical ambitions and political cultural impositions, not unlike early 20th century Germany. Just as the war in Vietnam cannot be taken out of context of all our wars, neither can the massacres at My Lai and Haditha be taken out of context of all such massacres past and present. The guilt also belongs to the most sensitive and most altruistic, such as draft evaders who would not fight in Vietnam because they did not wish to kill or die, or the pacifists who fled the country or went to jail to avoid service in war, either Vietnam then and Iraq now. However moral or humane the intent of these acts, others are forced to fill the vacancies left by the idealistic and just plain scared. Draftees from lesser classes to the combat ranks in Vietnam, National Guards mobilized to Iraq and Afghanistan. Among soldiers, there are those more excessively brutal and those more compassionate than the average, although each is capable of both, however negative the theater for their acts and feelings. For the more brutal, whatever the origin of brutality, war is relief for hatreds and fears, racial bigotry and ignorance so finely honed by society. But for the compassionate, whatever the accident of compassion, war is agony, especially wars like Iraq and Vietnam, where the masses of people are indistinguishable from combatants and might also be combatants as well. The sensitive soldier begins to realize that he or she is fighting a people in their homeland who resist what he or she represents. He or she might think of themselves as counterparts to stormtroopers of every age who violently invade, on whatever rationale, the homelands of other peoples. The sorely tried compassion, even if genuine, is at the least suspect to his or her victims and to him or herself, and at most spiritually wretched because he or she will most likely not throw down their rifles and go against all they have known, no matter how piercingly they see through the hypocrisy he and she have been indoctrinated to believe since birth. For, after all, it is all each knows and can return to. In wars such as Iraq and Vietnam, where every single Iraqi and Vietnamese is or was the enemy, and that's a quote, and a threat to the existence of soldiers sent to liberate, again a quote, them from dictators or ideologies, the savagery rapidly escalates between opposing combatants until the generally acknowledged law of war is to kill before being killed. A young army lieutenant, leader of the platoon that slaughtered the citizens of My Lai, was held primarily responsible. His name was William Calley. He was a small man for a country to hold accountable for its war crimes. And that was what the My Lai trial was really about. If Calley were to be found guilty of the murder of a lesser amount of civilians, reduced from 500 claimed by My Lai survivors to 102, he would be the only guilty party, not the rest of us, for whom his punishment absolves of any guilt. And if he were absolved, we would all be absolved, soldiers and citizens alike. And Calley, certainly no Dreyfus, for he was indistinguishable from his government's purpose, claimed in his defense that the murdered innocents at My Lai were those he was told to kill, that he had been told by senior officers they were Viet Cong sympathizers, and so must die to validate the deceit of American manifest destiny. He was found guilty, but not severely punished. He was no Jesus Christ either. And that was something I wrote, My Lai at the Millennium. Now I'd like to read something written by a fellow named Ron Ridenour. And let me give a little of a bio about him. Ridenour, after being honorably discharged from the U.S. Army in 1969, following a tour of duty in Vietnam, wrote a letter of complaint that initiated the investigation and subsequent revelation of the My Lai massacre. He helped originate Dispatch News Service after Congress and the media initially ignored his charges. Seymour Hersh wrote the original article about My Lai for Dispatch News Service, which was disseminated worldwide. Ridenour returned to Vietnam as a reporter for Dispatch News Service and revealed the widespread use of Agent Orange as a defoliant. He died several years ago, for the most part ignored and unacknowledged for the two great services he provided for the nation. And he wrote this on the 25th anniversary of My Lai, A Lesson of Lost Innocence by Ron Ridenour, March 16th, 1993. March 16th marks the 25th anniversary of the My Lai massacre, an event that shattered the fondest illusions of many Americans, myself included. Foremost among those illusions was the notion that the war crimes committed at My Lai, an event I now think of as a terribly accurate metaphor for our conduct of the entire Vietnam War, were acts that Americans simply would not commit. As helicopter pilot Hugh Thompson, who was at Mylai and saw what happened there, later told me, "We're the good guys. We don't do those kinds of things." Thompson, who landed his helicopter at Mylai in an attempt to stop the slaughter, died in 2005. But shortly after 7 a.m. on March 16, 1968, the 1st Platoon of Charlie Company, one of three U.S. infantry companies assigned to Task Force Barker, began landing just outside a small village in central Vietnam, intent on doing exactly what Thompson, I, and I believe most other Americans, didn't think American soldiers would do, massacre an entire community of unarmed, unresisting civilians. Over the 4 hours that followed, however, Charlie Company, supported by two other infantry companies, artillery and a helicopter battalion, all under the direction and the watchful gaze of nearly 20 senior officers, systematically slaughtered almost 500 people. The vast majority were women, children, and old men. At one point, a young second lieutenant, William L. Calley, ordered the machine gunning of dozens of villagers who were standing under guard on the edge of a ditch. It was, a friend who had been there later told me, a Nazi kind of thing. Later that same day, roughly 2 miles away, another Task Force Barber unit, Bravo Company, similarly massacred 90 people in a village called Maiki 4. My personal education into the hard nature of modern reality, it is fair to say, began with my arrival in Vietnam, which was the mother of all object lessons in just how far from truth government officials are willing to stray to get their way. Rather than saving democracy-loving Vietnamese civilians from the ravages of foreign invaders, we seemed to be the foreign invaders, and we were doing the ravaging. While the Mylai massacre was the local consequence of the smaller, far more numerous day-to-day atrocities I had witnessed up to then as a helicopter door gunner, hearing the story from men I knew and trusted, fellow soldiers who saw and participated in Mylai, staggered me like nothing before. America's education, at least that nasty, brutish part of it, began 18 months later when the story of Mylai broke into the headlines of newspapers all over the world. With few exceptions, Americans were as stunned by Mylai as I had been. American officialdom, compelled to concede that the Mylai massacre was indeed real, quickly began doing everything they could to shift full responsibility for the slaughter onto the lowest-ranking officer, Lieutenant Calley. But Mylai was not the consequence of a lowly second lieutenant who went berserk. It was instead the inevitable outgrowth of overall U.S. military policy in Vietnam. Mylai and Mai Ki were two of many such massacres during the course of the war, and without question, the specific acts and responsibilities of officers far higher up the military food chain than Calley. Although he was the only officer convicted for his conduct at Mylai, subsequent official investigations concluded that at least a dozen officers higher in the chain of command bore direct responsibility for the massacre. But these conclusions were ignored for the most part until after Calley was convicted, until after the officers above Calley who issued, transmitted, or remained silent about the massacre orders were either acquitted or not tried, and the public was no longer paying attention. If you were to sample people randomly on the street today about what happened at Mylai, the huge majority, if they have any clue at all, will tell you something like this. Isn't that the place where that lieutenant went crazy in Vietnam and killed a bunch of villagers? No matter how you say it, it seems to me, that spells cover-up. In that vein, it always strikes me as particularly ironic to hear American news people, writers and pundits, cluck their collective tongues when they talk about the reluctance of German society to embrace the brutal and tragic history of Germany's war crimes during World War II. Seldom do you hear or see any of the same folk raise similar questions about American conduct in Vietnam or America's reluctance to cast an unflinching eye on what we did there. We will serve ourselves and future generations well, in my view, if we openly and honestly examine those similarities and the questions they raise. More important, what happens if we don't? can we ever truly become the society of justice and equality that we claim to be if we do not deal openly and honestly with who and what we have really been. And that was by Ron Ridenour, A Lesson of Lost Innocence. And as I said earlier, he did two great things for this country, of which he's not particularly acknowledged. He revealed My Lai to the American public, and also the use of Agent Orange. Those were some very important things to have done, and he did them. Well, before I go my way this week, again, I'd like to thank everyone who pledged for this program and who pledged for the radio station in general to keep us on the air, independent of fussy Republicans who always want to destroy community radio or public radio, however you want to call it. And I'd like to give a little promo of Fresh Air this morning. It's on the list here. It seems rather interesting. It's how companies are saving billions of dollars through shifting their income overseas. Investigative reporter Jesse Drucker explains how multinational companies like Google and Forest Laboratories, which makes the antidepressant Lexapro, save billions by sending their profits on a worldwide journey full of corporate tax avoidance. Forest is a company that does almost 100% of its sales here in the U.S. They have almost 100% of their employees in the U.S. They're headquartered in New York City, and yet the majority of their profits show up overseas, most of them attributed to a mailbox in Bermuda. We will hear an interview with Drucker, who has written extensively about income shifting for Bloomberg News. And that is at noon here on KMUN. And I'd like tomorrow to one more holiday, wish a happy birthday to a young woman I know. She is going to be a teenager tomorrow. God help us all. So happy birthday, Charlotte. I thought it was going to be her golden birthday on the 13th, but I got it wrong. She's got five more years to wait. And this has been Michael McCusker.